a story I will tell. Pretty boy Floyd, an outlaw, Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee. It was Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon, as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language, and his wife she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed the log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun, and in the fight that followed he laid that deputy down. There's a many a starving farmers, the same old story told, how this outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you of a stranger that come to beg a meal, and underneath his napkin left $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There come a whole carload of groceries with a letter that did say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief, here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Now as through this world I ramble, I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, some with a fountain pen. But if through your life you travel, and as through your life you roam, you will never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Well, that's damn straight. A normal outlaw won't drive people out of their home. Won't take their home away. The banks do that. The banksters don't have any sympathy with banksters. Never did. Never did. Terrible Tommy here. Show B for September the 15th, 2008. Moon's Day. With a full moon, too, on Moon's Day. How about that? Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Have you got a few loose shekels around? Put them in an envelope and send them to us. Address your envelope to Tom Metzger or the insurgent, or even box holder. We'll get it. And we don't ask all the time for money, but obviously we can use it, and we put it to good use. And like I say, we're trying to get the old Race and Reason show fired back up again. And there's going to be some cost of that and so forth, and travel expenses. I'm going to have to travel about 50 miles once a week or at least once a month to do the show. And so whatever you can afford, do it. And you guys out there are downloading the show for free, as opposed to our good buddies who are paying their way. Yeah, put a few bucks in an envelope and send it to us once in a while, you know. We have hundreds of people on that list out there. We send the news and views, and our associates do a lot of work to put that together. And now it's amazing that we get almost no contributions from people getting it free off the website. And these are people who, a whole lot of them will talk to you about, well, it needs to be a revolution. Well, the money that most of those people send, we couldn't even start a bar fight, let alone a revolution. So don't forget that. If you know somebody's listening to our stuff and not contributing, well, tell them if they don't contribute, you're going to kick their ass. And if you're not big enough, you'll get another guy to help you. Okay, that's enough of that. Here we got Frank Bawa going to give us a lecture this morning. And I'm going to turn it over to Frank Bauer any second now and let him fly. Let him fly.
This is Guerrilla Radio, the one and only Guerrilla Radio, a subsidiary program of The Insurgent. And once again, I'm going to be reading out of the highly prophetic and magisterial War of the Flea, picking it up in, I believe, the sixth chapter, talking about the Viet Minh. As guerrilla war is a form of fighting by the masses of the weak in a badly equipped country against the aggressive army with better equipment and techniques. This is the way of fighting a revolution. Guerrillas rely on heroic spirit to triumph over modern weapons. It says avoiding enemy when he is stronger and attacking him when he is weaker. Now scattering, now regrouping, now wearing out, now exterminating the enemy. They are determined to fight everywhere so that wherever the enemy goes, he is submerged in a sea of armed people who hit him in the back, and thus undermining his spirit and exhausting his forces. Fortunately for his cause, Giap, who was the leader of the Viet Minh, by the way, the general in the field, Giap had absorbed the practical wisdom as well as the political rhetoric of his mentor, so that he is on solid ground when he writes, and I quote here, "In addition to scattering to wear out the enemy, it is necessary to regroup big armed forces in favorable situations to achieve supremacy in attack at a given moment and in a specific time to annihilate the enemy. Successes in many small fights added together gradually wear out the enemy manpower, while little by little strengthening our forces. The main goal of the fighting must be destruction of the enemy manpower." And I also want to include in there destruction of resources also. Sometimes just destroying resources will be just as detrimental to their losses as the loss of manpower. But he says that our own manpower should not be exhausted from trying to keep or occupy land. Once again, we don't seek to control any kind of real estate. By not controlling real estate or having what they call, you know, buildings on real estate or whatever, it keeps our overhead down, our cost low. Like I said before, if we keep our small and mobile, it don't take a whole lot of money to keep our operation afloat. It also says that Giap's definition of his objectives is purely military. In a colonial situation, the political effects of guerrilla war are less important, perhaps, than in a war against the native government of a semi-colonial country such as Cuba. Certainly, they were less important in the case of a nation defending itself against an invader. France's role after the Second World War. Remember, the French were the occupying army of Vietnam. After World War II, France dedicated all their military resources to Indochina. Well, most of them, and they also dedicated a lot of them to Algeria. Both of them were losing causes, by the way. That's not to say anything against the French people or the French fighting forces. I had the opportunity to train with the French army when I was stationed in Germany, and they were a strack army. They were trained well. They were in shape. I never saw a fat French soldier. I saw all kinds of fat soldiers in the American Army. All the times I got an opportunity to train with the French or the British Army, never saw a fat soldier. Wonder what's going on with that. But this is speak of the effects of the struggle on government morale and on the world opinion. Clearly, the primary task of militating the people, and that's infecting them with a militant spirit, retain the same vital importance in Vietnam as anywhere, a fact which Giap himself recognizes. Writing of the first years of the long guerrilla campaign, he says that in the beginning, there appeared to be a tendency not to take into due account the part played by political work. And the political workers did not yet grasp that the main task was political education, ideological leadership. You know, looking at the United States and our dumbed-down society and how we're distracted with mass entertainment from mass media, I don't think that going out in the street and trying to educate the masses is going to... it's been done for so long, I don't think it's going to really do anything. I think we just need to go out there and do whatever we can to bring about a discomfort to the white masses. I'm not saying that I hate my own race or that, you know, I'm going to war against my own race, but I want to do whatever I can to pull them away from the TV, pull them away from the Super Bowl or baseball or whatever. I mean, I've met people who like to use the N-word, have no problem saying the word nigger, but yet, you know, cheer for their favorite black football player on their favorite football team. So it's like, you know, their racism doesn't apply to their pet niggers, but it does to everyone else on the street. I don't think we can have that kind of mindset in our struggle. You know, I don't see how you could be an insurgent and be a fanatical advocate for the survival of the white race and be watching football and you know, caring about it so much that, you know, if your team loses, it affects your day or it affects your weekend. If that's you, then you need a serious, you need to really think about what you want out of this life. You know, none of us are going to live forever. You know, on a long enough timeline, the survival rate for everyone drops to zero. Remember that line in Fight Club? That's my favorite line out of that whole movie. And, you know, what are we living for in this life? You know, we've been allotted a certain place and time to live out our existence, whether it be 40 years, 80 years. You know, what are you going to do with that time? Just blogging on some blog site about race and just going into one of these chat rooms and talking about race, that's not going to do us anything. I mean, you know, I saw V for Vendetta last, the movie. I've seen it for a second time. I saw it at the theater the first time. But, you know, what he said in that movie, that, you know, you can kill the man, but you can't kill the idea. You know, I think just an idea just based on words is fine at the beginning. But that beginning of our ideology, our viewpoint, our world view, fuck, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here. You know, every time I get on this kick, I just get flushed with all kinds of emotions. I guess I feel very strongly about this, that we need to abandon the tactics of the past. You know, I know I'm going to make some enemies saying this. I have nothing against Nazi lowriders. I have nothing against Aryan Brotherhood. But to try to revitalize the standard of the swastika in our lifetime is just not going to work. And putting on demonstrations and flying the swastika with police protection is not going to work. And you know what? You're going to hear me harp on that again and again. I mean, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I'm hoping just one guy who's involved in that kind of activism maybe hears one of these shows and decides to see the, you know, take a step back, take a step out of the box and look at how it's not doing anything. It's not affecting our race at all. In fact, if it's anything, it's making us look bad. And if that's going to make me some enemies, I don't go out of my way to make enemies. I know I say some things on this that a lot of people don't like, but, you know, I gotta be real with myself. So, continuing on here with War to Flee. Writing for the first years of a long guerrilla campaign. I read that later, however, the tear was perceived and due attention was paid to the key political problem, that of uniting the nation in all its social sectors and joining all ethnic groups in a multinational country against foreign domination. I don't know about that enemy of my enemy is my friend for a while. I can see the point of that, or the logic of that on one hand, but then again, you know, part of me, I don't want to join with any Palestinian group, or I think like this. I think if there's going to be a Palestinian group or a black militant group that's going to do things on American soil that's going to fuck things up, basically chaos, I'm not going to stand in the way if their target's going to be any white working class neighborhoods or blacks want to do something militarily against a certain job site because they don't have enough black workers on this construction site and it has too many white workers, then that's something that I would try to interfere with. But if they're going to, like, rob banks that are controlled by the system, or if they're going to, you know, storm Capitol Hill or one of the capitals of one of the state buildings or whatever, I don't think I'm going to stand in the way. I think I'm going to let them do what they're going to do. You know, that don't mean I got to break bread with them and join them. But ideologically, I'll hold the door open for them. Ideologically, I'll, you know, supply them with gasoline if they want to burn down, you know, the State Department or whatever. Not literally, but I got to supply them with any kind of propaganda. If they're going to go anti-system, calls out for it, then fine with me. As long as they don't mess with the white working class, that's all I care about. If they go after the white rich, well, you know, depending on how I feel, you know, I may not interfere with that. I may just give them my blessing. So, you know, who knows? So we're going to have to wait and see how this pans out for us. Remember, this is going to be our own thing that happens. We put our own stamp until the war thing kicks off. Okay. The party strove hard to avail itself of favorable opportunities to push people into the struggle. Totally agree. We can do all kinds of things to get people riled up. We could do that with flyers. We could do that with other means of activism. But Gap relates, Giap, his last name is spelled G-I-A-P, so I guess that's pronounced Giap, you know, zipperhead name. Relates with considerable candor. And again, the National United Front was to be a vast assembly of all the forces capable of being united, neutralizing all those which could be neutralized, dividing all those it was possible to divide. Early neglect of the peasantry was quickly rectified in the face of the realities of a war in a peasant country. And the agrarian reform with the slogan, land to the tillers, became a rallying cry for the revolution. You know who's neglected in our movement? I'm going to tell you. I feel, or neglected in our struggle, I feel that the poor white people of Appalachia and the Blue Ridge Mountains and the poor whites in maybe Texas and the poor whites that are in California, if there is poor white there. But I believe that we're overlooking a vast, I don't know, a potential ally here. I know that they're deeply, you know, entrenched in Christianity. But you Christian identity guys out there, you guys can go to these communities and make some serious inroads. You know, don't be afraid of these snake handlers. A snake handler can handle a gun just like anyone else. Can you imagine militarizing the poor white in Appalachia? How about the truckers and the farmers? How many of you guys are on short radio just riding around the Northwest and just preaching this stuff, preaching what's happening to us, sharing about what's happening in hate crimes that are happening against white people, getting people stirred up. I don't see enough of that. Maybe that the media censoring any kind of activity that's going on like that, but I don't know. I guess I got to go with my first instinct and maybe believe that maybe that stuff isn't happening. And if it's not happening, then shame on us. Okay. The enemy of the Vietnamese nation, writes Gap, was aggressive imperialism, which had to be overthrown. But as the imperialists had long since joined with the feudal landlords, that sounds familiar, the anti-imperialist struggle definitely could not be separated from anti-feudal action. You know what? We cannot settle, we cannot divide or separate the race problem in this country from those who have economic power in this country. And that's the corporations, that's the media moguls. And I would even put in that group the people that are in colleges, you know, the professors and the professors who have tenure in a lot of these diploma mills, who not only poison the minds of white kids with racial guilt, but they militarize students of color. And if you don't think that's going, I worked for four colleges, and as an employee of the college, I was able to take free college courses because I was an employee. And I've seen that, and I've butted heads with a lot of these professors. And just to give you a quick story about the diploma mills, and the one I want to rally against the most is the College of DuPage social Marxist pigsty, pigfuck diploma mill in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, 25 miles west of Chicago. It's a predominantly Republican area, but that's not going to help us out at all. That's not anything to our aid. But this diploma mill, College of DuPage, I was an employee there. I worked there at night, sweeping the floors, mopping the floors, and I went to school during the day. And because I was a full-time employee, to be a full-time student, I mean, that would be 12 credit hours. I just didn't have the time because you had to read a lot. You had to read, you know, many pages of these textbooks to be able to know what was going on in class. So I was a part-time student but a full-time employee. And after about a year and a half of this, I had a grade point average of 3.8 out of a possible 4.0. You couldn't get higher than a 4.0. And I took a English class, an English 102 class, and it was a self-paced class, meaning that I only had to report to my instructor on Friday. He would give me my assignment, and then I would work on it throughout the week at my own leisure. But it was for people, it was for adults who had full-time jobs, who had families or whatever. It was a self-paced learning class. And my teacher gave me, I use that term loosely, teacher, he gave me an assignment. I had to write a four-page paper on anything I wanted. I had to have at least three sources and have five references. I wrote a seven-page paper. I had 10 sources and 15 references, and I put a bibliography at the end of my paper there. And I wrote it, and the title of my paper was America's Unsung Problem. And it was about the Jewish control of the American media. And when I reported to my teacher on the following Friday, you know, he gave it like a cursory look over. You know, he said, "Oh, wow, this looks good. Wow, you really did a good job on this. I mean, you used bullet points. You quoted Immanuel Kant here. Wow, this really looks good. I can't wait to read this. All right, I'll see you next week, and I'll let you know how things are going." I get a call from the English department at the College of DuPage social Marxist pigfuck university that following Monday. I met him on a Friday, my so-called teacher. I didn't even get a chance to see him on the following Friday. I got a call from the English department on Monday, and it was from some lady who says, "Yes, Mr. Frank Bauer, your teacher, whose name I don't want to say right here because I don't want resist.com to come under any lawsuit, but I said, he never wants to see you again. I said, what's the problem? He said, your paper really upset him about the Jewish control of the American media. And mind you, this teacher was not a Jew. He was like a Frank Zappa wannabe. He was a hippie. And the lady told me that they passed my paper around to the entire English department. Nobody would take me as a student because of my paper. Finally, some Arab lady, some Muslim lady, took me as a student in my self-paced learning class, and I had to meet her the following Friday. And she said that she read my paper. I wrote a very good paper. I couldn't disagree with it. It was well-written. It was well-researched. But she can only up my paper. The original teacher gave it an F. She can only up it to a D. So that put my grade point average from a 3.8 down to a 3.6. And it was at that point where I said, the scales just fell from my eyes. That the fix was in. You cannot infiltrate the system thinking you can reform it. I recommend that you infiltrate the system to bring it down. I recommend you infiltrate these institutions. You know, not to reform. You're not going to reform anything. You're not going to sneak up on our enemy. They've pulled out all the stops. They know all the tricks. Don't think you're going to sneak up on them. I mean, that's what a lot of these organizations are trying to do, like the Council on Conservative Citizens. They think they can sneak up on the Jews in America and wake up white people without making the Jews aware of what's going on. Come on, the Jews wrote the book on this stuff. You need to infiltrate these institutions to bring them down. Maybe not to bring them down to a fiery explosion. I'm not talking about that, but to bring disorder into them, to bring chaos, to bring... I mean, can you imagine doing something, leaving some kind of very controversial propaganda in one of the classrooms or in one of the teachers' offices and claiming to be from the... some black militant group or some Hispanic militant group. Think about that. So infiltrate the institutions, not to reform them, because you're not going to reform nothing. They got your number. If you even hint at anything showing one glimmer of white pride, they're going to come after you. And once they come after you, remember, they have all the power. The only power we have, like I said a couple programs ago, is disruptive power. So make sure you use that power. Okay. The enemy of the Vietnamese nation, I read that. Okay. On the other hand, in the backward colonial countries such as ours, where the peasants make up the majority of the population, a people's war is essentially a peasant's war under the leadership of the working class. The general mobilization of the whole people is, therefore, neither more nor less than a mobilization of the rural masses. I think I just alluded to that by going into these communities in Appalachia and southern Tennessee and southern Kentucky. A failure to form a broad popular front, especially one including the religious sects, notably the Buddhists, but in our case, the fundamentalist Christians, maybe, cost the Viet Minh dearly in South Vietnam at the beginning stage of the struggle. Now, we're not Christians. Well, maybe some of us aren't. Some of you listening to these shows are. And you can go to these... you can't go to a racially mixed church thinking you can... do something with that church. That is an enemy institution. You need to go to some rural, all-white church, you know, whether they speak in tongues or not. You can pretend. Think about this. I mean, a church that speaks in tongues, and a lot of you Christians out there, you know what I'm talking about, or you ex-Christians. You can go to these fundamentalist, evangelical, Pentecostal churches and get up in the middle of a service and act like you're speaking in tongues. Basically, it's just gibberish. Or, they have it at these services where somebody will stand up and speak in tongues and somebody interprets. You can stand up and interpret and says that the Jew is the enemy of America and that the Jew is the enemy of all the white people. And and that the Jews' lackeys, which are the corporations and the politicians, that they're an instrument of Satan. I mean, come on, use your imagination. There's nothing we can't do. Okay. As the late Bernard Fall, who wrote a book called Street Without Joy in the Two Vietnams, remarks, French objectives in Indochina in 1946 envisioned little more than a campaign of colonial reconquest along classic lines, like Marshal Leautry's campaign against Ibn el-Krim Rif Cabal in the 1920s. I guess some French guy who went against some Muslim guerrillas. The method chosen was the so-called oil slick technique. It involved the establishment of strong points in a region from which pacification forces would spread out to cut the countryside into small squares, and then to comb each square on the grid, working from the outside in, until the rebel forces within the net were finally brought to close quarters and exterminated. It is, in effect, a police method. The trouble was that Leclerc, who was the French guy in charge, did not have a sufficient number of policemen for this maneuver. And the combining without which the whole plan falls to pieces. Well, I don't think that's going to be the people we go against in the future. I don't think they're going to really lack manpower. Our number one thing is to blend in with society. You know, swim in the sea of the people. I was thinking about something yesterday. Going on a guerrilla op or a lone wolf op, whatever you want to call it, if you're wearing army fatigues, you're going to stand out. If you're even wearing black military fatigues, you're going to stand out. But there is a way to dress that's good for operations like that. For one, I recommend loose-fitting clothing. You want to be able to climb over a fence or climb over an embankment or something. You can't be wearing tight pants. You got to be wearing a not a military style boot, but maybe not a soft tennis shoe either. But you know, you look at the terrain that you have to negotiate, and you need to scout out the terrain that you're going to operate on before you even think about doing anything, and realize what kind of foot gear you're going to need, because the last thing you want to do is to go half-cocked on some kind of so-called lone wolf op and not realize that you're slipping and sliding all over the place because you didn't have the forethought to think about proper foot gear. It's something as simple as foot gear can keep you out of the system's net, then you need to think about that. Okay. I want to switch over here for a minute. I want to check in on our buddy James Mowry. See what James is up to today. I think I left off last time. James is on the run from the secret police. I'm going to pick it up. I think I read the first part of this on the last show, so I'm going to pick up on the middle of it. It says, darkness was his only help, not counting his legs. He pounded through alley after alley, bolted across six streets, halted in deep shadows. He was about to cross the seventh. A car, bulging with cops and plain clothes, the police slid past, its windows full of faces trying to look everywhere at once. For a short time, Mowry stood silent and unmoving in the shadow, heart thumping, chest heaving, a trickle of sweat creeping down his spine. As soon as the hunters had gone, he was across the street and into the opposite alley, racing onward. Five times he paused in concealment. What's the concealment he paused in? Probably shadows. The bushes. The shadows of trees. You know what my favorite tree is? I love weeping willow trees. You know, with the branches that extend down to the ground. But if you were to go inside this veil of leaves, it's like, you know, it's like a tent almost, where you have the trunk in the middle and you have these leaves that surround all around. I love weeping willow trees. I've used them as pretty good concealment at times before. Okay. mentally cursing the delay while prowl cars snooped around. They were looking all over the place for this guy, I guess. The sixth stop was different. He lurked in the alley's corner as headlights came up the street. A mud-spattered car rolled into view and stopped within 20 yards of him. The next moment, a solitary citizen got out, went into a nearby door, and shoved the key into its lock. James Maury came out of the alley like a cat, moving with great speed. The door opened just as the car shot away with a shrill scream from its engine. Struck with surprise, the civilian wasted half a minute gaping with mouth open after his vanishing property, then let go a solid curse, ran indoors, and snatched up the telephone. Remember, you can only get so far. Remember that. The cops have a saying, you can beat my four-way, but you can't outrun my two-way. Going a couple pages further, it says here, then he dropped the telephone, scrambled out of the booth, and hightailed it to the fastest pace that would not attract attention. Nearby, a bored shopkeeper lounged in his doorway, idly watched him go by, so did four people gossiping outside the shop. That meant five witnesses, five descriptions of the fellow who had just used the phone booth. He had just placed a threatening call to the secret police, and he noticed that when he got out of the phone booth, he was the subject of conversation for a group of people. You gotta know, if you're gonna use any, if you're gonna use anything that it's a communication device, like a phone booth, or you gotta casually look around you, see who's paying attention to you. And you have to dress in a way that doesn't attract attention to you. Like I said before, you gotta dress in a way and act in a way that if you met someone and you had an exchange with that person, just maybe a hello or a greeting, they need to forget about you 10 minutes later. You need to be bland. You need to swim in a sea of people. Now I wanna address something here real quick. I guess there's this hardcore woman out in California. I guess that she's kind of an ass-kicking girl from what I understand. And she's a racialist, and I guess she's not really too keen on some of my ideas or whatnot. Obviously, she hasn't heard all of, you know, all the things I've had to say, whether it be a monologue or shows I've done with Tom. But I'm an outside of the box type of thinker. I don't limit my ideas. You know, if some Mexican, some mestizo has an idea to do something, I don't think I'm betraying my race if I think that his idea may work. I believe fanatically in the separation of the races. I believe fanatically in the survival and advancement of the white race. And I want my time, my short time left on this mud ball called Earth, to be solely dedicated towards that purpose. Now, I'm not being soft at all when I go into a group of Mexicans that I've come to know and act like I'm their friend and to get certain information. I guess if she kind of rallied against that or whatever, that maybe I was kissing ass or whatever. Believe me, I'm not saying I'm a master of deception, but I practice deception all the time. I practice lying. You know, I do this with family members. I mean, not about anything serious. I'll just, you know, I'll be with my family member, and I'll just think of something right off the top of my head. You know, they'll ask me, why didn't I come to so-and-so's birthday party? And I'll come up with this real elaborate story right off the top of my head that is so believable that it just, they're like, wow, you went through all that? I mean, you know, I practice being deceptive, and I practice being deceptive right off the top of my head. I want to be able to think on my feet at a moment's notice. So, what this lady doesn't know, this woman doesn't know, and I appreciate her hardcore stance. I really do. I wish there were more white people like her. But the fact of the matter is, a majority of the white race is acting cowardly these days. So to go out on the street and yell nigger, 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 and getting in a fight and this and that, I mean, I believe you can do more for your race outside of jail than you can inside of jail. And if you can stay out of jail by swimming in the sea of the people, by not acting like a racialist, but doing, if you're going to take this course of action, if you're not going to get tattoos, if you're going to be as bland as you can be, and if you're not going to talk about race at all, then you have to be doing some hardcore stuff if you're going to take that line. You can't take that approach and think that you're being an activist by getting on a computer and getting in these chat rooms or whatever. That's not activism. That's not what's needed right now. What is needed is people who see their own power, and that their own power is disruptive power. We need WASP is what we need. All right. Let's check in on James again. All right, he's connecting with his contact on Earth with his communication device. Wolf had asserted that one man could pin down an army. Maori wondered, well, I guess he wasn't talking to Wolf at this point. Yeah, I highlighted some things here, guys, so I'm picking up different things at different aspects of the story, so forgive me for that. He's thinking back on a conversation he had with his handler. Maori wondered how large a number he fastened and what real good it had done, if any. How many precious man-hours had his presence cost the foe? Thousands? Tens of thousands? Millions? That's something to think about right there. Get the system to be chasing a fictitious organization that doesn't exist. Get the system to be chasing figments of your imagination. Let them waste millions or thousands of man hours on this. You know, let them be, you know, if that causes them to look away from a certain group as a real threat, and then that group acts out and they are successful and it hurts the system, don't get mad. None of you out there should be mad at 9/11. I'm mad at the loss of life, but I don't really blame Al-Qaeda for it. I blame our country. I blame our government. I blame the corporate elite, the transnational corporation, highly suited, well-heeled men and women who comprise the decision-making apparatus of these demagogic organizations. I mean, you know, they're the ones to blame for this. Every time I watch Zeitgeist, that movie, that two-hour movie that's on Google, you can type it in if you want. That's an eye-opener in itself. But every time I watch certain pictures of 9/11, you can see people falling out of the buildings. You know, when the plane hit, you can see people being thrown from the windows. And they're like, what, 100 feet up in the air, 80 feet? I mean, I don't blame these sand niggers for that. I mean, I hope there's going to come a time when we deal with them, especially those that decide to live on North American soil and European soil. But you need to be angry at our politicians for that, because the two targets they chose were finance and American military, the two things that we have used to back up Israel, who are the bully boys in the Middle East. So, I think Israel needs to stand on her own. We need to stop sending them money. Say, hey, God bless you. Good luck. They could probably do well by themselves. They probably don't even need our help. But Maori thought how many man hours his activities have wasted. So, what forms of war service would those man hours have been devoted if James Maori had not compel the enemy to waste them in other directions? And the answer that hypothetical question lay the true measure of a WASP efficiency. Your efficiency, lone wolf, future guerrilla, insurgent, is to waste resources, whether they be man hours, whether they be actual physical things. You need to be an instrument of chaos. You need to be a WASP. not in an area you work, not in an area where you live, but in an area where nobody knows that you have any connection to. We need to think about this real good. Evidently, the enemy was obsessed with the notion that the quarry sought sanctuary only in heavily populated places. I recommend you do that, definitely. If there's a natural disaster, though, you know, I heard Tom Metzger say before, get away from people. You know, we've had flooding in the Chicago area this past weekend, like a lot of places in the Midwest. And being in an overwhelming Hispanic area that I am, these people are just clueless when it comes to flooding. I mean, just, you know, streets are flooded, the mall parking lots are flooded, but yet they just got to go to the mall. They can't forego going to the mall. One weekend, they got to go to the mall, these goddamn parasites. Populated places. It just hadn't occurred to them that anyone would take to the wilds. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, this tactics works on this planet, Don, because these people who live on this planet, they don't like the wilderness. You know, if you hide in the wilderness and you're surrounded by law enforcement, they can put a cap in your ass and there's going to be no witnesses there that's going to say, hey, it was an unjustifiable shooting. He had his hands up, he was surrendering, and so forth. So hide in populated places. This was logical enough from their viewpoint. They having expected DAG, remember that was the fictitious organization, that was the revolutionary organization that Maury was spreading propaganda about. They haven't accepted DAG as a large, well-organized... Oh, they having accepted DAG as a large, well-organized group, too big and too widespread to lurk in a cave. That kind of makes sense. I could see that in that respect. The WASP had magnified himself to such proportions that they weren't going to waste time looking in holes for him. Think about that. He has caused so much disorder that he had the police force, a secret police on this planet, looking all over for a large group, and it was just one guy. I love this story, WASP. I encourage you guys to buy it, to read it, to reread it, get whatever kind of... I don't think this Eric... What's his name? Eric Frank Russell. I don't think he meant it as something to be studied, but there are some things that I got out of it that maybe if you read it, you would get something different. Okay. The damn fool came down from the roof straight into the arms of two waiting secret police. Not satisfied with that, he gave them some lip and went for his gun. This was one of the guys that Maury recruited. Remember, Maury, he sought the criminal underground of this planet and kind of reached out for them to do some jobs or whatnot. And he was paying them with counterfeit money. So not only was he inflating their economy with counterfeit money, but he was soliciting the help of some of the criminal underground of this planet. And remember, let's not forget that we can use... criminal organizations. Let's not look down our nose at criminal organizations. They could be a big help to us. Okay. If he behaved as if he had every right to be up there, he could have talked his way out of it. Gerd couldn't talk his way out of an old sack. Gerd was his helper, I guess. Oh, that was it. I guess what I highlighted was that, you know, you need to act with casual confidence, and you need to act like you have every right to be where you are. If you're inside a building and you went to a thrift store and you bought a custodian-looking uniform, You know, you can get a bunch of keys that aren't keys to doors anymore. Put them on this huge key ring and just walk around inside a building. First of all, you need to go in that building. You need to find some reason to be in that building and look at how the custodians are dressed. Okay, they have a plaid top with brown Dickies work pants on. Okay, now I'm going to go to the store. I'm going to buy something that looks like that. Then I'm going to get a name tag made up, and you can get that made up very simply. Put that on, go in the building, carry around this big thing of keys like you're a custodian or whatever, and you're a new guy on the block, or you're a new guy on the job, and walk around and recon, and maybe there's a child molester who works there who assaulted your cousin, and you can get to him, and you know, and then you can flee the scene. And when the people say, "Oh, he was dressed like a janitor," and when you get a block away from the building, you take off the plaid top and the brown Dickies work pants, and underneath you had a white pair of painter's pants on and a blue T-shirt. Yeah, because you went to the thrift store and you bought oversized clothes to fit over the clothes that you were going to escape and evade in. So you got the police chasing a guy with a beige top and brown pants, and not a guy wearing white painter's pants and a blue T-shirt and wearing a different hat. So just some things to think about. Use your imagination. All of you out there got great ideas. All of you out there got tremendous imaginations. You need to use them to the best of our ability. You need to use them for the service of your race. This is Frank Bauer, and this is the end of this episode of Guerrilla Radio. I hope you guys liked it. Hope you guys are getting something out of it. I got a number of books to read from in the future. I think you guys are going to like some of this stuff. But don't get all, you know, bent out of shape that, you know, we're talking about Arab assassins and the tactics that they used against crusaders. Don't get bent out of shape about that. Don't worry about where the source comes from. Just get the ideas and then tweak them for your own specific situation. Remember, there's nothing that we can't do. 14.
To hear your voice after all this time. I've been told that I'm hard to find. It's raining here, but I'm keeping dry. For me, that's doing good. To tell the truth, there ain't much to know. Dealt some cards and I've dug some holes. I haven't found that pot of gold like I said I would. Between the high lines and fence posts, the interstate and the dirt roads, no matter how the wind blows, I hear your warning. Out of all the things I've done that I regret, there's only one I'd like to change. Out here between the rainbows and the rain, last month in Santa Fe, I heard your daddy pass away. I should have called your mom to say how sorry that I am.
I don't think I'm coming back. It's been too long, and I guess that's that. But it's nice to know that you still ask about me now and then. Between the highlands, the fence posts, the interstate and the dirt roads, no matter how the wind blows, I hear your name. And out of all the things I've done, I regret there's only one I'd like to change. Out here between the rainbow and the rain, out here between the rainbow. Around trying to track you down, why'd you out till the coast?
so long for Frank Bauer and Terrible Tommy. That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow, Tuesday. Yeah, nice day here in the Heartland. 14 words wherever you're at.